You're listening to a chapel service recorded at Asbury Theological Seminary in Orlando, Florida. For more information, visit asburyseminary.edu.
Buenas tardes. You've been practicing the language of heaven. Very good. Very good. Now you're closer to heaven than ever before. All right. I've been telling some of you, you know, it's not Peter who's going to be at the gate of heaven. It's going to be Pedro. So you better practice that. Remember, hi, Pedro. Hola, Pedro. That will work. That will work. So get ready. In 1995, for whatever reason, the Lord decided that Georgina and I and the kids were going to be moving to the States. We were in Honduras before that, obviously, being very busy, doing many things, and he decided that we needed to pursue more education. So for whatever reason, he decided that Wheaton College was going to be a good place to go. Didn't have a clue about Wheaton, didn't have a clue about Chicago, didn't have a clue about the weather in Chicago. Clueless completely, and I found out really soon, because we moved that fall, and that January, my goodness, we were really ready to pack up and go back home immediately. It was hard, but we didn't know, we didn't have a clue either that God had so many surprises, very good surprises in his plans for us. Besides a solid education and meeting so many wonderful people, we were blessed and continue to be blessed by just getting to know Dr. Richard Butman, who is our lecturer for today. I didn't understand him my first class that I took with him. Didn't get a clue. And I didn't speak English either, so, you know, for to say, I think it was in part because I didn't get it, but he was so deep, so intense, so passionate, that it took me by surprise. Actually, he was a contrast compared to other faculty members that I was meeting at that time. Very intense. So I started to pray and ask for help. How do I at least get a C here and pass the course? Very, very quickly, he facilitated the way to become more than just a student and a faculty member type of relationship. He became a friend. And we found out that he actually had ties in Honduras, and he loved my country. He went to Honduras many times, even before we met. So that started to open some doors. And quickly, he became more than just a professor to us, and a friend, a really good mentor. And we need to be very, very honest by saying that a lot of what happened in our lives after we moved to that area was facilitated through him. I think God used Richard Butman in many ways to help us out through, to navigate, you know, because this was a very hostile environment for us. And it is not because of the language. Many different reasons. Midwest is not very friendly. But he just helped us to understand so many different things. So we became more culturally sensitive to the differences, but also as becoming psychologists and professionals, he helped us in so many ways to really understand what is it about being a Christian psychologist in the context of the U.S. and how we can also translate and use that in our own contexts, meaning our own countries and also the huge Latino population that we have here, and the fact that Latinos are going to run the heaven anyway. So we just needed, amen, we said, all right. You see, I had to say these things. They don't give me the mic all the time, you know. I had to take advantage of it. So I am enjoying it. In your bulletin, you have a brief bio of Dr. Butman. He's been teaching at Wheaton College for a long time, 28 years now, and he's been a licensed clinical psychologist. He actually graduated and got his PhD from Fuller Theological Seminary. So we have fans here, Theo, as you can see. And he's been an author, co-author. I was just reading his Vita, and it's incredible. A lot of articles and chapters that he's been writing about stuff, and also books. And we use in our courses two of his main books, that I think are probably the most relevant stuff that we can find right now in terms of integration, one particularly in psychotherapies and another one in psychopathologies. And other stuff is coming, I know that. So he has a big brain, but besides being so smart, he has a huge heart. He has a huge heart and a passion for his students, for teaching, for mentoring, for building relationships and lives. And I'm proud of being the product of that, honestly. Thank you, Tio, for being so wonderful. He asked us a long time ago, instead of calling him Dr. Buttman or Rich, just to call him Tio, which is uncle in the language of heaven, Spanish. So you know. And he's become, you know, honestly, I lost my father, you know that, over a year now. And he's become a father, a tío, so many different roles in my life. So it's an honor for me to be able to introduce him to you folks. And he has prepared a really interesting lecture. And you had the title also at the front of your bulletin, Making Sense of Human Pain and Suffering, Implications for Servant Practitioner Scholars. After his presentation, we're gonna wrap up this time, and then we're gonna move to questions and answers time at 2:15. And in that time, you please feel free if you can stay and ask all the questions relevant to the lecture or other things that he might be able to address during that time. So let's get as much as we can from him. He has to fly back to Chicago tonight. He's teaching tomorrow morning at 8. So he really, it's an honor to have you here, Tio. It's a privilege. Thank you so much.
I've taught long enough to know that you don't believe your introductions, and if you do, you've got a pride problem. But gracias para sus palabras muy amables. Yo quiero hablar en la lengua del cielo. Georgina and Javier know me well enough to know that I could even crack jokes in Spanish without even knowing that I'm cracking jokes in Spanish. But it is a distinct pleasure to be here at Asbury. I appreciate the sponsorship of the lectureship. But it's been fun to hang in your community for a mere 24 hours now. It got me thinking of how much I miss the sort of affectively charged, revivalistic emphasis of the Wesleyan tradition. Wheaton's not Wesleyan, though it was founded in 1860 as a result of the Wesleyan Prairie Revivals. But I got in touch last night at the hotel was that my paternal grandfather was a Methodist minister outside of Syracuse. My parents were scheduled to be Methodist missionaries in China, and World War II broke out. And it was not till their retirement they got to the mission field. This time it was in South Korea rather than in China. But also some of my closest friends are Methodists. But I am by heritage an Anglican. I guess I would wish for all of us, irrespective of our tradition, that we'd all have the mind of St. Thomas Aquinas, the heart of John Wesley, the hands of a Mother Teresa, and I would add the prayer book sensitivities of a Thomas Cranmer, the chief architect of the Book of Common Prayer. A little autobiographical piece, because beyond Javier's generous introduction, I'm here because of a certain group of men. And if you look at the picture here, I'm going to point with a laser. This is my mountaineering group. We have been together 34 years. Apart from a contemplative order, we're not monks. That's remarkable. There's actually research on longitudinal friendships of North American males. The typical North American male, apart from a partnered relationship, has 0.5 intimate friends. Did you get the joke, 0.5 intimate friends? Half empty, half full. But just to give you a sense for the quality of this group, that's Walter Wright, for 12 years president of Regent College in Vancouver, PhD in New Testament study. He's an engineer for LA Power and Light, has 4 master's degrees, including one in creative writing. He's a professor at the Claremont Colleges in earth science. Some weirdo from Wheaton. The head of the largest Christian counseling center in the South, in Memphis. Newt Maloney, an ordained United Methodist minister turned psychologist, clearly the most important mentor in my life. And this is another good friend. For 25 years was an analyst in Pasadena and just took a position with the Hettyton Institute, which works with traumatized relief and development workers around the world. Everybody in this group has at least a master's degree in theological studies. And all the others, everybody has a PhD. You could kill for friends like this. I don't literally mean kill, but I'm a huge fan of the writings of Walt Whitman. And one of my favorite sound bites from the literature of Walt Whitman is, since we last talked, what things are clearer and what things are no longer so important. Despite the fact we're all over North America, we get together at least once or twice a year, and every one of us has the opportunity for half a day to answer those two questions. Since we last talked, what's clearer, what's no longer so important? And hence the motivation for today's talk. I just wish all of you have friends like this. And when it comes to the issue of the great theodicy debate, the single most powerful predictor of resiliency is who are your friends. So if you are in ministry, pastoral care, counseling, whatever, even if you're a pulpit-type person, it's important to know who their friends are. Our friends define us. To quote retired Wheaton professor M. Griffin, you might recognize his name for a number of books on interpersonal communication, what a friend we have in Jesus, but what a Jesus we have in friends. And all truths of the Christian gospel need to be incarnated in real-life applications and interpersonally mediated. For those of you who don't like 1 o'clock in the afternoon heavy-duty talks, it's about the relationship, stupid. You will know there are Christians by their interpersonal compassion. And if you look look more closely at the King James Version of Scripture, the three things that repeatedly occur, they confess Jesus Christ as Lord, they seek after righteousness, and love the brothers and sisters. I think the first one is clearly creedal, confessing Jesus Christ as Lord. The second one is spiritual formation, and I take that very seriously. And the third one, loving the brothers and sisters, clearly strikes me as an interactional, interpersonal issue. Okay, so that's the Walt Whitman soundbite. Since we last talked, what's clearer, what's no longer so important? And for my money, most of my writing has been in the area of integration. If you're curious, Javier has this on PowerPoint. And I'm under photocopy restrictions with my department chair at Wheaton. I've single-handedly equaled the entire budget of a 19-person department with my photocopy handout. So I asked my chair, could I make PowerPoint handouts for this group? No way. Over my dead body or something like that. But Javier's got the hard copy if you want it. For my money, the two biggest issues facing Christians in whatever form of ministry you are is the whole discernment debate. For nearly 40 years of my life, I was a part of the Worldwide Anglican Fellowship, and I've taken great comfort from the Wesleyan Quadrilateral, which I applaud your tradition for, science and reason, scripture and theology, the church and tradition, experience and wisdom. I've seen a tradition I love be torn asunder by discernment debates. How do we know that we know that we know? All epistemologies have ethical implications. And so there's two things I'm passionate about these days, that my students know truth. And not just that they have truth, but the truth has them and oozes from their pore. And you'll see where I'm headed with the problem of pain on that issue. The other thing is basically what I've been hearing from my students. Why does a loving God allow so much pain and suffering in this world? And if you're a world citizen and a world Christian, you've got to wrestle with that issue. I'm a third culture kid. Wheaton, Illinois is not home. Despite the fact I've lived there for 28 years, I have a bi-coastal identity, and more frankly, a Latino identity. I was born into predominantly Jewish urban New York City. Wheaton, Illinois is culture shock for me, and it remains culture shock. But I see myself as a resident alien in a strange land. And I think the most profound discussions of the problem of pain have come from resident aliens in a strange land. It's so cool that your associate provost and his wife have Zimbabwean roots. if you haven't sat with your brothers and sisters in a place like Zimbabwe these days, you just don't get it. Do you follow? And when I think about my parents' 12 years of service on the mission field in Korea, hanging with the Koreans in the underground church in North Korea teaches you something about what truly matters from the perspective of eternity. So these days, I'm real big on being a world citizen and a world Christian. And I get off my butt as much as possible. The world does not revolve around the Billy Graham Center at Wheaton College. That's where my office is. This summer, I'm going to Quito, Ecuador. I've never been to South America, but I'm going to a LaArche-sponsored community in Quito. And quite frankly, the patron saint of my department is Henry Nouwen. And every time someone says Henry Nouwen, we genuflect, which is interesting, because at Wheaton, we have the Inklings, the Wade Collection, C.S. Lewis, Dorothy Sayers. So it's interesting, we're a sort of dissonant department. You know, Henry Nouwen, a contemplative Catholic, in a department of people who love the writings of C.S. Lewis. At Wheaton, if you don't quote C.S. Lewis, you're not worth salt. And I actually have a C.S. Lewis in this talk, but I have four Henry Nouwen talks. So that tells you about my priorities. So I want to be a world citizen and a world Christian. It pleases us immensely to know that our daughter realizes that the western suburbs of Chicago is not the end of the conversation. She's had the privilege of being in Honduras twice, including weekly trips to a kitchen on the west side of Chicago, if you know Chicago, Lawndale community, where people are very, quote-unquote, low-resource, but in some ways really rich. And she realizes that it's about service, stupid. She's decided to forego college this year. She's working in the extreme north woods of Wisconsin in a place called Honey Rock Camp, where she does housekeeping, works with the 40 horses up there. She's learning to cook. She left last June at her high school graduation not knowing how to cook anything. Now she's cooking for hundreds of people. There's hope, parents. There's hope. And she keeps telling me, I love what I do because I know I'm serving God. I wonder where she got imprinted in her formative years. Tegucigalpa, Tela, San Pedro Sula. There's a fair amount of research. If you don't get immersed in dissidence in a critical period of your life, you'll never get it. And those of you with counseling interest out there, you've got to get off your butt and come alongside people. All right, I think there's a fourth one up there. At Wheaton, the language is a servant, practitioner, scholar perspective. The big debate in organized psychology, are you first and foremost a scholar or first and foremost a practitioner? It's affectionately called the Boulder versus Vail debate, two different training models out there. But at Wheaton, it's scholarship for servanthood. In other words, it's not about, quote unquote, professional identity. It's not about your practitioner identity or your scholarly identity. It's about whether or not you can be a servant to the least of these. And we take that very seriously. My department of 19, probably half of them will every summer will be overseas in places like New Guinea, Honduras, recently the Ukraine, because it really affects our pedagogy and our way of relating to the students. And it's especially powerful when you do that in collaboration with students. All right, that's the introduction. You're thinking, my gosh, it's 1:30, and he's just getting started. Well, frankly, I have to take my jacket off because I'm getting real hot here. Little joke before I go up to the main thing. Thank you. It's actually highly intentional. I had the pleasure of doing chapel at Wheaton on the cusp of spring break. You may have heard we had 80 inches of snow this year. It snowed in Chicago yesterday morning. We are so hungry for spring. Graduation is a week from Saturday. Go figure. It's still winter up there. But I'm terribly homesick for, warmth. And it's been nice to sweat today and have a wool jacket on. And you don't know what you take for granted. Okay. Next one. I don't know about you, but I suspect one of the ways you cope with the demands of everyday living in Asbury and in your community is by staying busy. The hypomanic defense is alive and well in the Christian community. Be careful that you confuse busyness with godliness. The older I get, the more I realize the value of what the Hebrew word calls sitting Shiva with people in pain. As in coming alongside Job's comforters. And the first mistake they made was on day 7 when they opened their fat mouth. You'll see where I'm going with that. The whole one there. This is my humorous prop. I bring you greetings from the land of Lake Wobegon. This is the loon. Where all the women are strong, all the men are good-looking, all the children above average. That works, the Midwest, Florida. Garrison Keillor, Prairie Home Companion, whatever. There you go. Off the record, he's the unofficial pastor to more than a few Wheaton College professors. All right. I had the privilege of going to undergraduate and graduate school with John Ortberg. You may have heard of his name. Former teaching pastor at Willow Creek, now teaching pastor at Menlo Park Presbyterian Church. What I've done in this talk is give you the favorite sound bites of my students about the problem of pain. The more I teach, the more I realize what they remember are the Buttmanisms, not the content. But these are not Buttmanisms. These are profound statements about the problem of pain that I've spoken to my students over the last 28 years. First one from John Ortberg. Friends, we are in a contagious world. We learn to keep our distance. If we get too close to those who are suffering, we might get infected by their pain. It may not be convenient or comfortable, but only when you get close enough to catch their hurt will they be close enough to catch your love. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. You can't do ministry cloistered in your office. The next statement up there, Thomas Merton read him as an undergraduate. His book, The Seven-Story Mountain, gave up a professorship in literature at Columbia to pursue a reclusive life. Wrote in excess of 30 books, but said something profound about this great theodicy debate. The truth that many people never understand until it is too late is that the more you try to avoid suffering, the more you suffer, because smaller and more insignificant things begin to torture you in proportion to your fear of being hurt. Be careful what you pray for. The last 10 years of my life have been incredibly painful. Two parents with Alzheimer's, one who died in August. Two sisters with breast cancer, one who's died, one who will die shortly. Loss is huge. When I turned 50, my nice, neat, compartmentalized world was obliterated, and I'm still standing, and my soul's never been this large. But I think it'd be fair to say overindulged North American culture is scared spitless of suffering because we prefer to be antiseptic about it and anesthetize ourselves. My father was an anesthesiologist. The profession of medicine with the highest rate of addictions is anesthesiology. Think about it. Put you to sleep, pain management. Maybe the choices we make in life say something about who we are in terms of our identity. Next one. It's been said in the literature that loss is the pivotal experience of life. It's universal. It's inevitable. Henry Nouwen, the first of three sound bites, our patron saint, Genuflex. The pain is like a plow that breaks the ground to allow the seed to take root and grow into a strong plant. Every time you experience pain, you're faced with a choice. You can become bitter and decide not to love again, or you can stand straight in your pain and let the soil on which you are standing become richer and more able to give life to new seeds. Scripture is replete with gardener images. The more you have loved and have allowed yourself to suffer because of your love, the more you will be able to let your heart grow wider and deeper. My father died at 10:45 on August 7th in Atlanta, in my arms, on the 23rd Psalm. Yea, though I walk through the valley of death, I will fear no evil. I read from their 50th anniversary Bible. They made it to 64 years. And my father's breathing at the end was in rhythm to the cadence of the King James. Went through the entire Psalter. I've read about this, but it's not till it happens in your arms. Yea, though I walk through the valley of shadow death. He had one eye. All I can think of was Moby Dick. Those sorts of losses can affect you. But only if you're willing to stare it in the face. My sister, who died of breast cancer, her favorite psalm was 139, verse 8 and 10. If I make my bed in hell, even there your strong arm will find me. Lou Smead says that's the ultimate security of our faith. The primal security that God will not abandon you. Amen? Can I get a witness? I think Wesleyan said get a witness. Okay, next one. All right. Phil Yancey is a Wheaton grad. You probably read some of his stuff, too. This was my reference earlier to Christians in North Korea, El Salvador, Zimbabwe. The German pastor theologian Helmut Tillich once observed that American Christians have an inadequate theology of suffering. Who would disagree? More, how could we expect our theology of suffering to emerge from a society that has survived nearly two centuries without a foreign invasion, solves all meteorological discomforts with climate control, and describes a pill for every twinge of pain? We must turn instead to the Christians of El Salvador, South Africa, or North Korea, Zimbabwe, for a lesson in the graduate school of suffering. Okay. It kind of blows my mind. I think to some extent we need to recognize the fact we have so little to say about the problem of pain because we're not willing to face it in all its ugliness. Okay. Next one. I've had the privilege of teaching a bereavement course at Wheaton for 15 years. It was originally dedicated to my sister. There has been a loss every year of someone in my immediate or extended support system since I've taught that. Most recently, it was the patriarch of our neighborhood, Charlie Long, on four boards. Their firstborn son was the runner-up for the Heisman Trophy the year that Herschel Walker got it. You may have heard of him in the news lately. Number two son is a tax attorney in Phoenix. Number three son has cerebral palsy and multiple sclerosis, 28 years old. The Hebrew past tradition of sitting Shiva, the wake was 7.5 hours long. Gotta remember, it was still snowing this time of year in Chicago. You couldn't even get into the nursing home, the funeral home. In Latin America, there's a tradition, you know how much a person's loved by how many people follow the casket to the internment. Respecto. If you know people by their acts of kindness and generosity, that was an outpouring of love. On Sunday night, before I came down here, I had the privilege of talking with some neighbors, with Joan, his widow, and their son, Andy. And what can you say? You sit Shiva with them. And one of the neighbors made a chocolate cake, which was nice, and all that, too. Andy can barely speak except to say Cubs. Now, if you know much about Chicago and the Cubs, that's a statement about pain right there. And but imagine how many people suffer and don't even have the opportunity to use words. And in some ways, that's the gift of ministry, to sometimes give people words to things they previously did not understand. And so this is Jerry Sitzer, lost his wife, his mother, and one of his kids to a DUI, in which he and two of his kids survived. My students have said it's the best treatment of the problem of pain in English. If you hit one more thing, you'll see the reference. The cross, then, is not simply the means of our salvation, though it is that for sure. It's also the means of our transformation. It's the way of life we must follow if you want to close the gap between who we are in Christ and how we live from day to day. The cross brings good news on two levels. It promises to redeem us. It also promises to change us. Such change is bound to produce pain. It is painful to die to self, to embrace suffering, and to reconcile with opponents and enemies. The cross has provided for me not only a way of salvation, but a way of life. It's the only way to live. Jerry Sitzer, written after horrendous loss I don't ever want to face. A dear friend of mine is Gilbert Belzikian. You may have heard of him as Bill Hybels' mentor. Wrote a book called Christianity 101 and Community 101. Let's be real simple about this. Love God, love people. Love God, love people. And I've heard Gil give this talk several times on a newspaper thing. And he keeps crossing like that to the intersection, love God, love people, is a hole in the paper. You got to get your hands dirty. All truths about God, about people, about ourselves need to be interpersonally mediated and incarnated in real life applications. You got to get off your butts and get dirty, so to speak. Next one. Why is there pain and suffering? Gilbert Belzikian says, to try to answer the theodicy debate is evil. Chuck Swindoll said, stand in front of a mirror 20 times a day. Chuck Swindoll, I don't know. Dallas Theological Seminary, Dispensational Theology, Formulary 2, I don't know. Lou Smeads, clearly one of the most powerful mentors of my life, best practical ethicist I've ever read. I do not want God to make it plain. If he could show us that there is a good necessary reason for such a bad thing to happen, it must not have been bad after all. And I cannot accommodate that thought. His passion was infertility, adoption, and the homeless of urban Los Angeles. In fact, wrote this just after 9/11, I have given up why such things happen. Instead, I look forward to the future and ask, when? When is God going to come and purge evil from this world? When will he come to make his original dream for the world come true? To quote another favorite poet of mine, E.B. White, if I wake up in the morning torn between improving the world and enjoying the world, it really makes it hard to plan the day. If I wake up in the morning torn between improving the world and enjoying the world, it really makes it hard to plan the day. Next one. One of my dear colleagues who left Wheaton 2 years ago to go to George Fox with his wife, fourth generation Oregonians, wonder why they want to go home, just released a book called Integrative Psychotherapy, in which he cites the writings of Endo, arguably Japan's best novelist, a Christian, who talks about the persecution of the early Christians in the Church of Japan and how God seemed to answer them in silence. And, that's in our scripture, too. I am terribly suspicious these days of people that say discerning the will of God is like a blazing inferno. To quote another Wheaton alum, Elizabeth Elliot, it's a slow but certain light, like a single flickering candle in a long, dark tunnel on a cloudy night in a windy day. Elizabeth Elliot. I get suspicious when students tell me they got everything figured out in life, including answering the problem of pain or the problem of free will and determinism in one or two pages. Towards the end, in Endo's Disturbing Knowledge, Silence, I dare you to read this. This is going to force you to deal with some issues from a world citizen perspective. An apostate missionary in Japan exclaims, listen, I was put in there and heard voices of those people for whom God did nothing. God did not do a single thing. I prayed with all my strength, but God did nothing. And many have experienced the silence of God. I guess I want to say it's okay to lament. I appreciate the fact that you played Matt Redman and Beth Redman's song. Do you know the story behind that song? I'll show you the reference towards the end. The suicide of Matt's father, the abusive relationship with the second father, years of infertility, the agony of adoption, complete burnout in ministry. Every phrase from that song speaks volumes. It came out in Christmas of 2005, the story behind the story. And I have a growing appreciation for the narrative these days. Next one. I think we're asking the wrong question. Why is there so much pain and suffering? Why not? Jerry Sitzer, once again, why not me is as good of a question to ask as any. And since one of my contexts is the west side of Chicago, youth growing up in many inner cities witness violence and drug addiction so often that it is as common to them as green lawns and friendly neighbors are to most of us who live in the suburbs. Millions of people endure abuse of one kind or another. Why me? Seems to be the wrong question to ask. Why not me is closer to the mark once we consider how most people actually live. The two clinical sites I worked at that Javier referred to, and I think are in your program, one is forensic assessment, court-ordered evaluations, 350 a year that we do, the majority for abuse, violence, rape, trauma. And the other, the Latino context, which both Javier and Georgina worked at, our modal, typical client is a low-resource Latino woman on the receiving end of physical, emotional, sexual abuse. violence beyond my comprehension, illegal, with three or more kids, and a husband who's wildly promiscuous. That's the reality. And one of the things that keeps me alive at Wheaton is I keep putting myself in situations where I don't hear simple answers to complex questions, particularly, why not? Next one. There's three sound bites on this one that the students have nominated as ones that end up on their final examinations. The question is not how do you resolve the problem of pain, but what insights are enduring since we last talked, and what's clearer and what's no longer so important. I love this one by Mother Teresa. Many in this world ask of God, why don't you do something about all this suffering and pain? Perhaps God is asking us the same thing. I want to acknowledge the fact that her spiritual journals were recently published, which I think was a gross violation of her privacy. But I increasingly listen to the people who lament rather than the people who've got it all figured out, particularly people who are formulaic about the abundant life and image management and sin management. The obligatory C.S. Lewis quote. Genuflex. Dr. Litvin, this is for you. Oh, that's dangerous. He's our president. God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts to us in our pains. It's his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. What you don't know, that comes from a grief observed and the problem of pain after the death of his late wife, you know, late life marriage to Joy Davidman. If you saw the movie Shadowlands, two Wheaton professors were consultants on that. Anthony Hopkins got it right. The great sculpture scene, how superficial his response was in the beginning of the film versus, I don't know, at the end. The third one, Rob Bell, you've probably heard of his name, Velvet Elvis, sex guy. I gave him a C- as an undergraduate at Wheaton, and he wrote about that in print. He had the same experience. What language is Butman speaking? Can I get a C? He got a C-. Urban, New York, Jewish, intense, passionate. Do you get it? This is not Orlando. Well, Rob has quoted me several times in print. But my gosh, the fastest growing church in American history. He's got something right. He's been called a prophetic artist by more than a few people. His Numa videos, phenomenally helpful. Particularly his one, Matthew, on the problem of pain. Ultimately, our gift to the world around us is hope. Not blind hope that pretends that everything is fine and refuses to acknowledge how things are, but the kind of hope that comes from staring pain and suffering right in the eyes and refusing to believe that that's all there is. It's what we all need, hope that comes not from going around suffering, but going through it. That was so good, we need more Rob Bell. That's the next one. In the same book, Velvet Elvis, I love that title, Black Velvet, to truly engage with how the world is, our heart's going to be broken again and again. Just this past week, I met a woman who's terrified her husband's going to beat her. Another woman who has a degenerative muscle disease that's causing her face to freeze up. And I can think of at least five couples who are splitting up. And you get the picture. It's your world, too. And so we are learning to suffer well, too. Not to avoid it, but to feel the full force of it. It is important that churches acknowledge suffering and engage in it. Never, ever presenting the picture that if you follow Jesus, your problems will go away. Following Jesus will bring on problems you never considered. I don't pretend to know your Wesleyan heritage, but I do know that there are people within this tradition that struggle with image management, sin management, for whom sanctification is not grace, but law. And I, that's got to change. Chuck Swindoll, this is from his book, When God is Silent. Now, this, again, is profound. Former president of DTS, Dallas Theological Seminary. It's amazing how he's changing at the end of his life. Look at this. Three practical statements to those who suffer and identify with Job's struggle. First, there are days too dark for the sufferer to see light. Second, there are experiences too extreme for the hurting person to have hope, and there are valleys too deep for the anguished to find relief. All right, next one. Going again back to Jerry Sitzer, the supreme challenge to anyone dealing with catastrophic loss involves facing the darkness of the loss on one hand and learning to live with renewed vitality and gratitude on the other. The challenge can only be met when we learn to take the loss into ourselves and to be enlarged by it, so that our capacity to live life well and to know God intimately increases. Latinos understand that more than gringos. In Spanish, the way you play with the verb loss, perder, to lose, and sustain development, desarrollo, is often juxtapositioned together, which I think is a profoundly biblical concept. Well acquainted with loss and growth, refiner's fire, purgation. If you know the spiritual formation literature, dark night of the soul, all this kind of stuff. So loss, growth. Loss, growth. And in some ways, a willingness to go through it rather than to run from it. Nick Walterstorff. There's quite an interesting debate going on at Wheaton. One of the grandsons of our former Surgeon General, Everett Koop, was in our department. And he wrote a book about the loss of his son in a mountaineering accident at Dartmouth. It's called Sometimes Stones Move. Nick Walterstorff also lost his son in a mountaineering accident. He says, I can't believe in a God who moves the stones under my son's foot. Hence the debate about providence and suffering. Obviously, I'm quoting Walterstorff, which tells you where I stand on the debate. We are one in suffering. Some are wealthy, some bright, some athletic, some admired. But we all suffer. For we all prize and love. And in the present existence of ours, prizing and loving yield suffering. Love in our world is suffering love. Some do not suffer much, though, for they do not love much. Suffering is for the loving. I mean, this is the Christian gospel in a nutshell. If I hadn't loved him, he's talking about his son, there wouldn't have been this agony. The end of his book, Lament for a Son, is a requiem that they did at Calvin College in memoriam of his son. Unbelievable. This, said Jesus, is the command of the Holy One. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. In commanding us to love, God invites us to suffer. What I've noticed in this bereavement course, what affects the students more deeply than anything are requiem masses. For 600 plus years, the church has seen the value of requiem masses. For the last 6 years at Wheaton, we've had an on-campus requiem. Last weekend, it was the Berlioz requiem. 450 voice choir, 150 piece orchestra. Not only did it have the Wheaton choirs combined, but the choirs for Northern Illinois University, where Georgina got her doctorate, the murders on campus recently, and the choir from Valparaiso University, and a great soul choir from the city. I don't know, unless you're hopelessly arterial sclerotic in your tear ducts, I mean, do you follow? Wow! 15-minute standing ovation after it was over. Okay? If you're suffering, or your accounts are working with those who suffer, do not underestimate the value of requiems. For me, I want to be buried to Faure's requiem. I haven't had the chance to preach much in life. Some of you are, thank God for that. But on an all-souls service, I did basically a talk about loss. And there were 500-plus people in the room. And at the Eucharist, they read the names of lost loved ones. With the Faure Requiem and Paradisium at the end, in paradise, the angels will love you and hold you. That's the church being the church. And I would just remind you, the gospel is more than verbal, logical, propositional truth. It has to be felt and experienced in the deepest resources of our being. Ashley's parents are both teachers. She's dyslexic. The gospel's not words. Do you follow? Which is one reason why we worship in a place that takes all the senses very seriously. But that's... Next one. You're saying, this is a marathon, listening to you. Well, loss is a marathon. This is my dear friend who's the chairman of the Minnesota Licensing Board. She's a clinician up at Bethel University in St. Paul. She wrote this after being unemployed for 14 months, after getting her doctorate. And this was based on a Wheaton Chapel message. Real hope knows that life is sometimes ambiguous. A journey through valleys and over hills and in all kinds of weather and travel conditions. I speak of real hope, a hope that wavers, that flickers, that sometimes seems to have died, yet lives on in spite of the disappointment, despair, and perplexity. This is the hope that sustains us, for it is the evidence of God's love poured forth onto and through suffering humanity. Merle has coined the phrase, there's a world of difference between arrogant optimism, all things work together for good, and biblical realistic hope. I do not know. I do not understand. You hear nothing else today. Don't foreclose on the problem of pain. Next one. So you're saying, boy, this is a lot of consciousness raising. What about ourselves? Your turn now. What we've learned from the bereavement literature, there's a lot of secondary traumatization when you work with people that are hurting. And this is a nice little visual. An empty well can't give water. So what we're going to do in our sort of conclusion here is, what can we do to reverse the toxic effects of being with those who are well acquainted with suffering? And this was my sister's favorite soundbite in the final months of her life. And my students can stand and say this in their sleep, and it's on every final examination in my class. Like, this is the Buttmanism. It's actually the Yanceyism they remember most. Jesus did not come in this world to take away suffering or to explain it, but to fill it with his presence in his time. It's the last three words that drive me crazy. In his time. Maybe I'm not the only person who's impatient in this room. So the issue is, it's a marathon. We need to pace ourselves. Let me get a little bit more specific here. I have a Baptist love of alliteration, so you're going to see some S words here. But initially, I want to start with the soundbite from Jerry Sitzer. At the end of his book, A Grace Disguise, he talks about the funeral of his wife, his mother, and his daughter. And in their wedding ceremony, they sang the hymn, Be Thou My Vision. That's the unofficial hymn of the grad program, said Wheaton. I can't get through that without falling apart. That's how he ends his book, but with this paragraph before quoting the words of Be Thou My Vision. The grief I feel is sweet as well as bitter. I still have a sorrowful soul, yet I wake every morning joyful, eager for what the new day will bring. Never have I felt as much pain as I have the last 3 years, yet never have I experienced as much pleasure in simply being alive and living an ordinary life. Never have I felt so broken, yet never have I felt so whole. Never have I been so aware of my weakness and vulnerability, yet never have I been so content and felt so strong. Never has my soul been more dead, yet never has my soul been so alive. You see the paradoxes all over the place? This is biblical. This is not gringo culture. What I once considered to be mutually exclusive, sorrow and pain, sorrow and joy, pain and pleasure, death and life, have become parts of a great whole. My soul has been stretched. So I guess the point I'm trying to get across is, if we suffer well, I hate that phrase, suffer well, it builds our character, our compassion, our convictions, our communities, our commitments. And I want to take you now to some fascinating research literature. This is Asbury. Don't talk about research. I love research because I think it screams volumes of the church. Next one. Ken Pargament at Bowling Green State University has studied virtually every disorder and disease known to humankind, be it breast cancer, be it dementia, and so on. And this is a book which I think you may want to take a look at sometime. But the three things that tease out predicting long-term well-being emotionally, mentally, spiritually, are, number one, social support. Who are your friends? You know, to quote the Beatles, I get by with a little help from my... Oh, that comforts me. My current students don't even know who the Beatles are. And I remember when James Taylor and Carly Simon were a couple, and they say, James what? Number two, sense of efficacy. What do you do well? What are you good at? There is abundant research that catching people doing things right rather than pointing out what they're doing wrong helps them grow. And finally, what gets you out of bed in the morning? What keeps you going during the day? And the dark night of the soul, sense of meaning and purpose. if you hear nothing else, if you want to help people deal with pain, ask them about their friends. What do you do well? We'll get you out of bed. Then keep your fat mouth shut and see what they say. I teach psychopathology. From the Greek, it means the study of the calamities of the soul, which is interesting. This is a local clinician in Chicago, an agnostic Jew, as is Ken Pargment, but they read the research. Those concerned with the origins of psychopathology and with efforts to rekindle emotional growth must give serious attention to the possibility that the most devastating of human experiences is a sense of uselessness. And I think one of the hardest things about being in the culture of poverty is people feel hopeless, helpless, and powerless. And paradoxically, when you come alongside people and acknowledge that, it helps, which makes no sense to rugged individualists from North America. Okay, next one. On the cusp of spring break at Wheaton, I gave a talk about factors that do not facilitate spiritual formation. And I want to mention just a couple of them. First one, there's some research that was just released from Ministry in the Pacific Rim. The typical person who's doing ministry in the Pacific Rim sleeps 3.5 to 4 hours a night. That's an issue. Good sleep hygiene says 7 to 8 hours a night. Some of you are saying, well, talk to my oppressive professors and I might actually do that. Tan, Sunyat Tan, who's a clinician and a minister at Fuller, said he thought this was the single greatest detriment to spiritual formation. You don't sleep. Make no excuses for holy naps. I'm very serious. Next one. I have a niece who had triplets in March of 2006. Well, actually, it's not Harrison Ford, but when it's clear, it looks like Harrison Ford. I've been fascinated by sleep at the beginning of the lifespan, at the end of the lifespan. Having spent a lot of time the last couple of years in nursing homes, I mean, just watching sleep and breathing and so forth. But we forget that people in the middle of the lifespan need sleep as much as people at the beginning and at the end. Next one. Another thing I think that gets in the way of us sitting Shiva with people in pain is we don't spend enough time being still. I think taking time for solitude is absolutely essential in Christian community, and I would make no excuse for it whatsoever in the context of spiritual formation. And you're probably saying, Butman, do you practice what you preach? Take a look at the next slide. Long Lake, northern Wisconsin, 360 miles north of Chicago. That's my greatest passion in the world. Last summer, I was in this yellow kayak at the crack of dawn with the fog lifting up from Long Lake, and a deer came swimming alongside that kayak. Lord, take me to heaven. Next one. My daughter took this. That's someone sitting at the end of a pier on that same lake. And I just think it's neat that Wheaton has a campus 360 miles north of Wheaton, a place apart where people can be still and know that he is God. You know, there seem to be some places in this building where you could do that. But take some time to be still. Next one. Some of you may have heard of the late Bob Weber, huge worship person at Wheaton. Talked about in times of distress, flee to worship, flee to fellowship, flee to service. And then a dear colleague at Fuller, Al Duick, talked about the need to be thick in our communities. When spirituality is construed as an intervention that is universally applicable, moral content is thin. I prefer a thick particularist view of the faith community since it has memories, rituals, and symbols that differ from other faith communities. I encourage psychologists to elucidate the communal memories and religious traditions that clients bring to therapy to validate and nourish what is good of a client's ethno-religious particularity. This is faithful to my calling as a Christian to respond to the whole person God has created so they can live consistently within the narrative character of their faith. The older I get, the more I appreciate narrative theology and narrative psychology. And if you look at the next one, it kind of relates to the social support piece. I'm almost wrapping up. I just realized the time. I'm sorry. But I'm an event-oriented person. Soy un poco hondureño. If you take a look at the next slide, These are two of my dearest friends. This is Door County, Wisconsin, the tip of the peninsula, the thumb of Wisconsin. This is where we dreamt up the book, Modern Psychopathologies, A Comprehensive Christian Appraisal. He's become director of the Department of Spiritual Formation at Wheaton. This is Mark Yarhouse of Regent University. He's been in the news quite a bit. They were both students of mine. We spent four days kayaking in Northern Lake, Michigan, just talking about what it means to be deep, what's clearer, what's no longer so important. The net result was that book, which was a collaborative effort. It gives me great joy these days to not only be in community, but to do scholarship in community, to come alongside the Georgina Pantings and Javier Sierras of the world and see them make well in Asbury. I think you're all blessed for that. Next one. This is a faculty development retreat at Honey Rock. We've started with freshmen at Wheaton. We had 250 freshmen up there for 2 weeks in the woods along with these faculty members. These are some of Wheaton's best faculty. And this was taken doing a go-kart racing competition in St. Germain, Wisconsin. This represents 20 different disciplines at Wheaton. I can assure you there are no interdisciplinary differences when it comes to race cars. This guy here is 67 years old. You can't believe it. He's called Bionic Bud, and that's not a reference to your hip surgery. But he was an All-American gymnast at Penn State when they won the national championship. He was the gymnastics coach at Wheaton. There are people who live to beat him in anything. And in this go-kart racing, this guy right here, strongest man for his age in America, amateur, beat Bud. And we are talking about that in chapel four times this year, this picture. In other words, faculty members have a life outside the classroom. Go figure. Next one. I have a huge appreciation for the writings of Frederick Buechner. And he said this in chapel message at Wheaton, donated his papers to Wheaton. Can't wait to see them. What could be more important in the body of Christ than to tell our stories? And what could be more precious than to hear them being told? No matter what form of ministry you do after your studies here at Asbury, realize the power of narrative. And from the context of East Africa, we should make space in the body of Christ for storytelling. We really can't survive without stories. When people who live with the virus, HIV, AIDS, tell their stories, they name and claim their identities. Instead of others labeling you or speaking on your behalf, you name your experience and your reality. Telling our stories can also help us to make sense of what is happening. Through telling and hearing stories, we discover connections, and then hopefully we begin to care in new ways because the shared story of our faith is our sounding board. It shows not only Jesus' care and concerns for the suffering, but confronts us with a person whose life makes sense and gives hope, even when he suffers death on the cross. Barrett McRae and Mark Yarhouse said my most quoted Butman soundbite was that we would know each other so well we could finish each other's sentences for us, but care enough about each other to keep our fat mouth shut. Next one. Frederick Buechner, in his lovely devotional book, Listening to Your Life, and listen to your life, see it for the fathomless mystery that it is, and the boredom and pain of it no less than the excitement and gladness, touch, taste, smell, your way to the holy and hidden heart of all, because in the last analysis, all moments are key moments, and life itself is grace. Only two more slides. Again, my deep love for the writings of Lou Smeads. Hope can't be taught, it can only be borrowed from hopeful people. What's the truth that's within you? Disabled hopers need someone to give them a hope break, someone to take over for us until we get the bugs out of our hope. Everyone needs someone who can be a vicarious hoper. This is why hope survives best in a community of hope. That's what I wish for Asbury. You become a community of hope. We know people have hope for us when they know they trust us, and if we respect them enough to believe their trust, we gain a new hope for ourselves. And then here's the meta-analysis of all the research on psychotherapy change. And I think Asbury can speak to at least three of these, if not all four. Technique is only 15% of the prediction. La Esperanza hope, 15. What goes on between the helper and helpee, 30%. But 40% is the world in which the person moves. What would I say to Asbury? I hope you're talking about hope. La Esperanza. I hope you're talking about relationships between those offering ministry and those receiving ministry. I hope you're not focused only on technique, but I sure as heck hope you get off your butts and immerse yourself in the world. Because of the last slide. Superficiality is the curse of modernity. What the world needs today is not more intelligent people, but deeper people. And I hope it is said of you at Asbury that you can lend your hope to people who are in pain, but also to you see the issue is not becoming intelligent only, but wiser and deeper. And again, to paraphrase Robert Coles, you could get an A in a chorus at Asbury and flunk life. Thank you for listening.